Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the supposedly private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. During the last show, I discussed the concept of the tequila trap and gave an example regarding that with Mexico. And this is essentially international pirates prowling in a sea of floating currencies. Countries around the world have been caught in this trap, which, as I discussed, captured Mexico. Henry C.K. Liu calls it the tequila trap. He also calls it a suicidal policy masked by the giddy expansion typical of the early phase of a Ponzi scheme. The lure in the trap is the promise of massive dollar investment. At first, returns are spectacular, but as with every Ponzi scheme, the returns eventually collapse, leaving the people massively in debt to foreign bankers who will become their new economic masters. The former Soviet states, the tiger economies of Southeast Asia, and the Latin American banana republics all succumbed to these rapacious tactics. Local ineptitude and corrupt politicians are blamed when the real culprits are international banking speculators armed with tsunami-sized walls of credit created on computer screens. Targeted countries are advised that to attract foreign investments, they must make their currencies freely convertible into dollars at prevailing or floating exchange rates, and they must keep adequate dollars in reserve for anyone who wants to change from one currency to another. After the trap is set, the speculators move in. Speculation has been known to bring down currencies and national economies in a single day. Michael Chasudovsky, professor of economics at the University of Ottawa, writes, quote, "The media tends to identify these currency crises as being the product of some internal mechanism, internal political weakness, or corruption. The linkages to international finance are downplayed. The fact of the matter is that currency speculation using speculative instruments was ultimately the means whereby the central bank reserves were literally confiscated by private speculators." End quote. While economists debate the fiscal pros and cons of floating exchange rates, from a legal standpoint, they represent a blatant fraud on the people who depend on a stable medium of exchange. They are as much a fraud as a grocer scales with a rock on it. If a farmer's pesos was worth 30 cents yesterday and is worth only 5 cents today, his dozen eggs have suddenly shrunk to 2 eggs, his dozen apples to 2 apples. The very notion that a country has to defend its currency shows that there is something wrong with the system. Inches don't have to defend themselves against millimeters, but peacefully coexist with them side by side on the same yardstick. A sovereign government has both the right and the duty to calibrate its medium of exchange so that it is a stable measure of purchasing power for its people. How a stable international currency yardstick might be developed will be discussed later on in this series. The tequila trap is the contemporary version of what Henry Carey and the American nationalists warned against in the 19th century when they spoke of the dangers of opening a country's borders to free trade. Carey said sovereign nations should pay their debts in their own currencies, issued greenback style by their own governments. Professor Liu also advocates this approach, which he calls sovereign credit. Carey called it national credit, something he defined as a national system based entirely on the credit of the government with the people, not liable to interference from abroad. Carey also called it the American system to distinguish it from the British system of free trade. Abraham Lincoln was forging ahead with that revolutionary model when he was assassinated. Carey and his faction, realizing that the country was facing the very real threat that the banking interests that had captured England would also capture America, then moved to form a bulwark against this encroaching menace by planting the seeds of the American system abroad. In the 20th century, the British system did prevail in America, but the American system was quietly taking root overseas. Now let's move on to see how freeing the Yellow Winkies from the wonderful Wizard of Oz is essentially the greenback system flourishing abroad. So from the wonderful Wizard of Oz, the Cowardly Lion was much pleased to hear that the Wicked Witch had been melted by a bucket of water, and Dorothy at once unlocked the gate of his prison and set him free. They went in together to the castle, where Dorothy's first act was to call all the Winkies together and tell them that they were no longer slaves. There was great rejoicing among the Yellow Winkies, for they had been made to work hard during many years for the Wicked Witch, who had always treated them with great cruelty. And this is called The Rescue from The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, and of course that's the book. According to later commentators, Frank Baum's Yellow Winkies represented the world's exploited and oppressed. In the late 19th century, the United States was engaged in an imperial war with the Philippines, which was vigorously opposed by William Jennings Bryan, the populist lion. The Chinese had also been exploited in the Opium Wars, and Chinese immigrants worked like slaves on the railroads of the American West. To Henry Carey, they were all victims of the British system, a form of political economy based on free trade and the gold standard. And I'll come back to this in a moment. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So as I said, Henry Carey called everyone a victim of the British system, a form of political economy based on free trade and gold standards. He wrote in The Harmony of Interest in 1851, quote, "Two systems are before the world. One looks to underworking, underpaying or exploiting the Hindu and sinking the rest of the world to his level. The other to raising the standard of man throughout the world to our level. One looks to pauperism, ignorance, depopulation, and barbarism. The other to increasing wealth, comfort, intelligence, combination of action, and civilization. One looks towards universal war. The other towards universal peace. One is the English system. The other we may be proud to call the American system, for it is the only one ever devised, the tendency of which was that of elevating while equalizing the condition of man throughout the world." End quote. In The Slave Trade, Domestic and Foreign, published in 1853, Carey wrote, quote, "By adopting the free trade or British system, we place ourselves side by side with the men who have ruined Ireland and India and are now poisoning and enslaving the Chinese people. By adopting the other, we place ourselves by the side of those whose measures tend not only to the improvement of their own subjects, but to the emancipation of the slave everywhere, whether in the British Islands, India, Italy, or America." End quote. America had narrowly escaped the fate of the Irish, Indians, and Chinese only because President Lincoln had stood up to the bankers, rejecting their usurious loans in favor of government-issued greenbacks. He had sponsored a government program in which the country would convert its own raw materials into manufactured goods, funding its own internal development by generating its own money, avoiding interest payments and subservience to middlemen, foreign and domestic. When Lincoln was assassinated and the British system got the upper hand, Carey and the American nationalists saw the need to develop a network of allies against this imminent threat. They encouraged political factions in Russia, Japan, Germany, and France to bring their governments in accord with Lincoln's policies, forming a potential alliance that could destroy the British Empire's financial hegemony. That alliance would later be disrupted by two world wars, but the foundations had been laid. The 100th anniversary of the American Revolution was commemorated in 1876 with a centennial in Philadelphia organized by Henry Carey and his circle. It was a world fair that celebrated human freedom and potential through collective efforts to develop science, technology, transportation, and communications. The Careyites funded Thomas Edison's Invention Factory, which displayed its first telegraphic inventions at the Centennial Exposition. Later, Edison was challenged by Carey's Philadelphia group to develop electricity, and Edison's partner introduced electric streetcars and subway trains. Many other countries had their own displays at the Philadelphia Centennial as well, including the French, who donated the Statue of Liberty, and millions of people attended from all over the world. Foreign delegates met with the Philadelphia group to discuss industrialization and development of an economic system in their own countries along the lines envisioned by Franklin and Lincoln. Thomas Paine had called debt-free government-issued money the cornerstone of the American Revolution, but it was being studied by innovative leaders abroad, and some of them wound up rejecting the privately created money of foreign financiers in favor of this homegrown variety. As Wall Street came to dominate American politics and the American media, these nationalized banking systems would be branded un-American but they were actually made in America, patterned after the prototypes of Franklin, Lincoln, Carey, and the American greenbackers. Russia and China developed national banking systems on the American model in the 19th century, well before the communist revolutions that overthrew their monarchies. Ironically, the Marxist political system they later adopted was devised in Great Britain and retained the class structure of the British system, with the small financial elite ruling over masses of laborers. The American system of Franklin, Hamilton, and Lincoln was something quite different. It celebrated private enterprise and the entrepreneurial spirit while providing a collective infrastructure under which competitive capitalism could flourish. This protective government umbrella furnished checks and balances that prevented exploitation by monopolies and marauding foreign interests, allowed science and technology to bloom, and provided funding for projects that promoted the general welfare, improving the collective human condition by drawing on the credit of the nation. Now we'll look at the Russian experience of this. America's alliance with Russia actually dated back to the 1850s, when Henry Carey helped turn American opinion in Russia's favor with his newspaper writings. Carey argued that America should back Russia against England in the Crimean War. Russia, in turn, sent ships to back Lincoln against the British-backed Confederacy. The American system of economics was introduced to St. Petersburg by the U.S. ambassador. In 1861, Tsar Alexander II abolished serfdom and launched an economic plan for developing agricultural science, communications, railroads, and other infrastructure, and America provided scientific and technological know-how to help Russia industrialize. In 1862, Russia established a uniform national currency, a national tax levy system, and a state-owned central bank. By the beginning of World War I, the Russia State Bank had become one of the most influential lending systems in Europe. It had vast gold reserves, actively granted credit to aid industry and trade, and was the chief resource of funds for Russia's war effort. A group of Russian entrepreneurs fought to copy the American system advanced by Carey and his faction, but they faced stiff opposition from the landed nobility, who were backed by international banking interests. Although the Tsar had liberated the peasants, the nobility forced such onerous conditions on their freedom that they remained exploited and oppressed. The peasants had to pay huge redemption fees to their former masters, and they were given insufficient land to support themselves. World War I imposed further burdens. Most of the working men were taken to fight the war, and those who remained had to work grueling hours in serf-like conditions. The people were forced off the land into overcrowded cities, where famine broke out. The peasants did not actually initiate the Russian Revolution, but when the match was lit, they provided the tinder to set it ablaze. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I am speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So now let's look at the Russian Revolution. The Russian Revolution was another experiment in utopia, but like the American Revolution, it got diverted to other ends. In The Creature from Jekyll Island, Ed Griffin maintains that there were actually two Russian revolutions. The first, called the February Revolution, was a largely bloodless transfer of power from the Tsar to a regime of liberals and socialists led by Alexander Kerensky, who intended to instigate political reform along democratic lines. This revolt was then followed by the far bloodier October Revolution. Why was the second revolution necessary? The reasons are no doubt complex, but Griffin suggests one that is not found in standard history texts. He says the October Revolution was essentially a coup in which Kerensky was overthrown by Vladimir Lenin with the support of Leon Trotsky, who came with substantial funding from New York. Trotsky, who is generally considered the hero of the Russian Revolution, was born in Russia as Lev Bronstein. He went to New York after being expelled from France for his anti-war activities in 1916. When he returned to Russia in 1917, it was with financial backing from a mystery source thought to be Jacob Schiff of Kuhn, Loeb, and Rothschild's main U.S. banking arm after the Civil War. Schiff was a business partner of Paul Warburg, the German immigrant who engineered the Federal Reserve Act. In an article in the New York Journal American, published on February 3, 1949, Schiff's grandson was quoted as saying that his grandfather had given $20 million for the triumph of communism in Russia. In 1904, Schiff provided the large war loans that allowed Japan to virtually decimate the Russian fleet. In 1905, the Mikado awarded him a medal in recognition of his important contribution to that campaign. Wall Street's support of revolution in Russia was portrayed in a cartoon published in the St. Louis Dispatch in 1911 by a Bolshevik named Robert Miner. The cartoon showed Karl Marx standing amid a cheering crowd on Wall Street with John D. Rockefeller, J.P. Morgan, and other prominent bankers eager to shake his hand. Why, asked Griffin, would Wall Street bankers support a communist revolution? Bankers were capitalists who should have strongly opposed socialism and communism. Griffin quotes Eugene Lyons, a correspondent for the United Press, who was in Russia during the revolution. Lyons wrote, quote, Lenin, Trotsky, and their cohorts did not overthrow the monarchy. They overthrew the first democratic society in Russian history, set up through a truly popular revolution in March 1917. They represented the smallest of the Russian radical movements, but theirs was a movement that scoffed at numbers and frankly mistrusted multitudes. Lenin always sneered at the obsession of competing socialist groups with their mass base. Give us an organization of professional revolutionaries, he used to say, and we will turn Russia upside down. Within a few months after they attained power, most of the Tsarist practices the Leninists had condemned were revived, usually in more ominous forms: political prisoners, convictions without trial and without the formality of charges, savage persecution of dissenting views, death penalties for more varieties of crime than any other modern nation. End quote. Russia was kept in the hands of a small group of elite called the Communist Party, which kept Russian commerce open to free trade and the banking system open to private manipulation. In 1917, the country's banking system was nationalized as the People's Bank of the Russian Republic, but this system was dissolved in 1920 as contradicting the communist idea of a moneyless economy. Griffin writes, quote, in 1922, the Soviets formed their first international bank. It was not owned and run by the state, as would be dictated by communist theory, but was put together by a syndicate of private bankers. These included not only former Tsarist bankers, but representatives of German, Swedish, and American banks. Most of the foreign capital came from England, including the British government itself. The man appointed as director of the foreign division of the new bank was Max May, vice president of Morgan's Guarantee Trust Company in New York. In the years immediately following the October Revolution, there was a steady stream of large and lucrative, that is, non-competitive, contracts issued by the Soviets to British and American businesses. U.S., British, German wolves soon found a bonanza of profit selling in the new Soviet regime. End quote. All right, if these arrangements were so lucrative for Anglo-American business interests, Why did the United States target Soviet Russia as the enemy in the Cold War following World War II? The plans of the international bankers evidently went awry after Lenin died in 1924. Trotsky was in line to become the new Soviet leader, but Stalin succeeded in grabbing the reins of power instead. For the Trotskyites, the Stalinist communism then became the enemy. Trotsky was expelled from the Soviet Union in 1928 and returned for a time to New York, meeting his death in Mexico in 1940 at the hands of a Soviet agent. The neocons, or new conservatives, the group most associated with the Cold War, had been traced to the Trotskyites of the 1930s. Through most of the rest of the 20th century, the neocons fought to reestablish dominance in Russia. Srdjan Trikovic is a journalist who calls himself a paleoconservative, the old right as opposed to the new right. He writes that neocons moved from the paranoid left to the paranoid right after emerging from the anti-Stalinist far left in the late 1930s and early 1940s. They had discovered that capitalism suited their aims better than socialism, but they remained consistent in those aims, which were to prevail over the Russian regime and dominate the world economically and militarily. They succeeded on the Russian front when the Soviet economy finally collapsed in 1989. The Central Bank of the Russian Federation was added to the League of Central Banks operating independently of federal and local governments in 1991. The economic destruction of Russia and its satellites followed. Jude Winiski, the Reagan-era insider, said that shock therapy was imposed on the Soviet countries after 1989 as an intentional continuation of the Cold War by other means. In a February 2005 interview shortly before he died, Winiski acknowledged that he was at one time a neocon himself, but he said that he had had to break with neocon policies after the Iron Curtain came down. He revealed, quote, "We were all cold warriors, united in a very hard line against communism in Moscow and in Beijing. We fought the Cold War together, and we were proud at being successful in that the Cold War without having a nuclear exchange. But when the Cold War ended, the Russians invited me to Moscow to try and help them turn their communist system into a market economy, and I was glad to do that for free. But I had to break with my old friends because they said we didn't beat these guys enough. We have to smash them into the ground. We want to feed them bad economic advice, shock therapy, so they will fall apart." And as we will see, shock therapy consisted of austerity measures imposed in return for financial assistance from the International Monetary Fund and its sister agency, the World Bank. Also called structural readjustment, these belt-tightening measures included eliminating food programs, subsidies, reducing wages, increasing corporate profits, and privatizing public industry. According to Canadian writer Wayne Elwood, structural adjustment is a code word for economic globalization and privatization, a formula which aims both to shrink the role of the state and soften the market for private investors. Mark Weisbrot, a co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, testified in 1998 that Russia's steep decline after 1989 was a direct result of the harsh policies of the IMF, which were used as tools for subordinating the domestic economies of emerging market countries to the whims of the international financial markets. And we will continue in the next program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from True LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.